Support for the Exchange Podcast from NHPR comes from you, our listeners,
and from the New Hampshire Department of Agriculture, Markets, and Food. New Hampshire's farms and farmers markets are full of fresh goods, rich with agricultural heritage, and available all year long. You can locate pick-your-own farms, farmers markets, fairs, and more near you using the directories at visitnh.gov/agriculture.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. Most of us interact with our energy system through the nozzle of a gas pump or the flick of a light switch. That was certainly the case for our guest today, UNH Associate Professor Tom Haynes, with his average American lifestyle of cars, home, work, and family. But 5 years ago, something about the installation of a new water heater inspired Haynes to explore the gap between the ease of energy consumption and the difficulty of energy production. And so he began a journey on foot through America's energy landscapes, from oil rigs to solar fields. The result is a new book called Walking to the Sun. And today in The Exchange, Tom Haynes is here to tell us more. And let's hear from you. Our email, exchange@nhpr.org. Again, exchange@nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange, or give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. And Tom Haynes, welcome to The Exchange. Good to see you.
Good to see you, Laura. Thanks.
What was it, Tom, about this very ordinary event? The guy comes over, he installs your water heater. It's completely a normal thing that anyone might experience, but it kind of made you go, oh my gosh, or aha.
Yeah. So, I mean, it happened obviously in a moment, and that moment has, you know, for years I have been reading headlines, right, about climate change and global warming and this idea that we need to stop consuming so much. And yet in 2013, my wife and I, we had two younger children, had bought a home in Durham, New Hampshire, a 1968 ranch, and it needed some updating. And as part of that, someone said, you should put in a new natural gas furnace. And so that's what we were doing. And I was hanging out in the basement with Joel, who was installing the furnace. And he was saying, this is going to be efficient, and it's going to be cheap because of natural gas prices were low. And it was all true. And yet there was this kind of cognitive disconnect between this is the very thing that we're learning we're supposed to be doing less of, right, which is consuming fossil fuels. And here I was paying thousands of dollars to basically essentially connect myself more permanently to that system. And a second piece of that was I'm from Pennsylvania originally, and Pennsylvania is one of the areas that has essentially been redefined by fracking, hydraulic fracturing and this drilling, which on the one hand has provided a lot more natural gas, has cheapened the cost of that energy, but at the same time has, again, committed us sort of deeper down a road of fossil fuel consumption. And so I was standing there in my basement wondering, like, what's going on out there? I'm a journalist by background, and I had done a lot of that kind of field reporting. And I thought, you know, that's something that I could maybe offer in this conversation about where we are, is to go to the source. And so, you know, I sort of metaphorically and symbolically followed the pipe across the roof of the across the ceiling of the basement and out the door, and thought, you know, I want to go to sort of see what's happening in these places where all of this is produced.
Well, it's so easy to consume energy. And here in New Hampshire, we don't have a lot of homegrown energy sources. But if you travel anywhere, you know, California, you see these giant wind farms on the brown hills out there. Travel through other places, Oklahoma, you see the sort of, you know, rigs pumping up and down. But here in New England, we're kind of disconnected from where our energy comes from.
Absolutely. And so in a sense, I mean, that was at the heart of what I was feeling, was almost this over-insulation, right? I mean, we live in this modern era, and I'm thankful for modern medicine. I drove over here in a car that all I had to do, I could hold my coffee in my hand and push a little gas pedal, and I traverse the state, right,
with
very
easy.
Little effort. But as you point out, you know, we don't often see the transaction of that, where things come from. Obviously, in an earlier era, people were chopping wood or, you know, out there kind of getting their own fuel, and in many parts of the world today still.
Working hard to get it.
There was a sort of an involvement in the transaction, right, between sort of what you needed to survive and how you were living. And now, because of modern technology, because of this industrial world we live in, you know, we're insulated within that, and we don't see it. And even kind of more conceptually, many of us, if you work in an office and your paycheck goes direct deposit deposit to your bank account and if you have payment for your electric bill set up, you don't even know how much you've consumed, how much you've paid. You've never seen the money you've earned. You've never seen it go out to pay. So again, a lot of convenience in some ways in those systems, but the net result is that we are over-insulated. Like, you just don't feel that sense. And at a time sort of as a society, I think, when we need to be more aware of that.
Well, right? Why does closing that disconnect or opening up that insulation, I think, as you put it, Tom, why does that matter? Some of these energy landscapes are quite unattractive and even unhealthy.
Yeah, I think that, I mean, you know, for a while, we were able to maybe not let it matter as a society when we didn't know the costs, right? But we've learned, I think, at the heart of the kind of climate change conundrum is that we've learned that we need to be more aware of what we're consuming and how, and by the what, I mean, whether it's carbon-based or not, and how much. And so I think I just felt, you know, I think that collectively we need to be more aware of that so that we can follow certain policy paths, but also just individually. I don't know about you. I teach at UNH, and I was talking to a group of college students about this, but there's a certain helplessness to this insulation. When we, you know, you read a headline and it almost doesn't matter. You know, 2 weeks ago, the UN International Panel on Climate Change came out and said, whoa, this is happening faster than we thought. It's going to be worse than we thought. We're going to be seeing some really significant impacts by 2040. And I looked around the room of college students. I said, how old will you guys be in 2040? And they were like 38, 39.
Not very old.
Right. So we're not talking grandkids. We're talking now, essentially. And so I kind of felt, just on a personal level, kind of helpless, you know, in the basement there, like, wow, I'm paying, you know, lots of money for this. I don't know how this all works. And so for me, as just a writer and in this journey, I mean, I think what I was trying to do was almost to kind of, you know, information is power. Right. It was to kind of try to understand it and feel a little less helpless.
Well, is information power? Because you're right. It's so big and the predictions are so dire. Is it power or is it powerlessness to understand what's going on?
A little bit of both. I mean, I'll have to admit, I mean, we can talk about the journeys in a second. But, you know, being out there, you know, I sort of went to these fossil fuel landscapes first and it became a sort of a reckoning of how much we consume. And I tell you, I was on an oil rig and just seeing what is done on one rig in one little corner of the United States, which is one little corner of the world in terms of global oil production. On an afternoon, I was there Memorial Day 2014, to fill gas tanks for that moment. You know, what it gave me, though, was a sort of an appreciation and a sense of what we need to overcome, which in a way increased, in my mind, sort of the urgency of the situation. Because it is the amazing thing of living inside our world of, you know, sort of on the receiving end of the fuel is it's a pretty calm world. You know, you kind of these problems seem theoretical. And when I was in the Bakken oil field in North Dakota, for example, and thousands of people drilling hundreds of rigs, you know, for oil, which has increased by 50% U.S. oil production, that in other places. And again, you know, in the short term, that has some potentially positive impacts. People will say, hey, it's cheaper fuel, it's energy independence, et cetera. But you sit there and you kind of feel on an organic level that we are digging deeper at a time when we shouldn't be.
So I do want to get into different landscapes that you walk through, and that's great.
Right.
And I want to let listeners know, you know, oil fields, fracking, natural gas, solar, wind. Tom kind of explored it all on foot, and we'll hear about that as well. I also want to remind you that you can join us. Our number here in the Exchange, 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. We're talking about a new book that explores this disconnect that Tom Haines talks about between the extreme ease most of us have with energy consumption and the real difficulty and challenges and costs of energy production. Join us with your thoughts. Email is exchange@nhpr.org or give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. One more thing before we get into some of the places that you walked through, Tom. The title of the book, Walking to the Sun. Now, you remind us in the book that all energy really does start with the sun, not just the obvious solar. A lot of people kind of probably remember, you know, science in school, how fossil fuels are created also by the sun. But just remind us, give us kind of a science 101 about how all types of energy that we consume here on Earth start with the sun, you know, fossil fuels, wind, tidal fuel, everything. A lot of folks will know this, but some folks might not
understand it. Oil, gas, and coal, which are the three predominant fossil fuels. And again, I'm not a scientist, but as a journalist, have sort of looked at this question a lot. You know, oil, gas, and coal, which are the three fossil fuels, were, you know, basically created from plant life that was generated by the energy of the sun, right?
Dead dinosaurs, we
sometimes
call it.
And you know, exactly, dead dinosaurs pressed underground. And in the case, I'll just give one example, we won't go there yet, but of the shale oil in North Dakota, for example, was buried, you know, 300 plus million years ago, 10,000 feet underground. So it's been sitting there as this, you know, carbon locked in the oil. And so, you know, the burning of these fuels is essentially the releasing of that stored energy. And, you know, so, right, so the book, the Walk into the Sun piece is sort of looking at sort of, you know, we have been living off of burning these big stores of energy, big stores of carbon in fossil fuels, and looking at more, you know, what are sort of referred to as, you know, renewable sources, carbon-free in the sense that the use of them does not create carbon dioxide emissions. But you're essentially, you know, with solar, you're basically capturing the active power of the sun. With wind, is basically, you know, is a currents of air moving from the power of the sun. And this, in even the, you know, the hydrologic cycle is driven, obviously, by sort of the sun power. That's sort of the idea. Metaphorically, too, the book follows from fossil fuels. I start in an oil field and I end in a solar field. So just on a very specific way, the journey's walked to the sun in terms of that level, too. So,
and all of these energy sources have their trade-offs. None of them are pure.
Absolutely. That's the reality of today. Like, we're beyond pure. Like, whatever we do is going to be a trade-off and a compromise in some way. 7 billion people on a planet who are, many of whom, a billion plus of whom, are accustomed to a really comfortable and convenient lifestyle, understandably. And so there's no kind of going back to following the cycles of the seasons from coast to inland lakes or ponds or something, as Native Americans in Maine did, for example, where I walked along the tides, you know, centuries ago. But the question is, can we keep much of, if not all, of our sort of modern industrial infrastructure and fuel it from beneath with something more sustainable and renewable?
And fuel it closer by.
Perhaps, yeah. Often that is the, you know, I mean, that's the big question, right? The, you know, fueling it from sources that are perhaps, if not local, more regional.
All right. Networked. Again, you can join us, 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. The book we're talking about today is called Walking to the Sun, A Journey Through America's Energy Landscapes. The author is Tom Haynes. He's also an associate professor of journalism at UNH and formerly the staff travel writer at the Boston Globe. We're taking your questions and comments by email, exchange@nhpr.org, or give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. So let's talk about this journey itself, Tom, and it's pretty amazing. What landscapes did you pick, and how did you pick them?
It sort of evolved. I basically wanted to, at the beginning, I knew I wanted to go out to fossil fuel landscapes, right? That when I was in that basement in 2013 and I was getting this gas furnace put on. And in that moment, you may remember, it was the boom in the Bakken oil field. And so I was looking for places, how did I pick them? I was looking for sort of fuel landscapes that would be kind of have a story to tell about that fuel. You know, if you're going to write a book about oil, as many have done, I could go all over the world and write about oil, offshore drilling in the Middle East and Venezuela. But I wanted to, first of all, I wanted to stay within our own country because I thought that was interesting to kind of look at what's happening here. But I also wanted to kind of find places that were at once unique but emblematic of the bigger thing. And in 2014, the Bakken oil field was it. It was the 1849 gold rush of energy production in the United States. The quick background is, you know, this method of hydraulic fracturing, which splinters rock underground, and horizontal drilling, which allows a pipe to go sideways through a layer of shale, had made oil that they knew was there for decades, but it just wasn't economically feasible or physically viable to get it out. It had made it accessible. So the rush was on.
So all those predictions years back about peak oil and we're going to run out, all of a sudden they developed new technology and voila.
And so it opened up a lot of existing fields, right? And in this case, and you also remember this was not too long after the 2008-2009 recession, people around America, a lot of people were having trouble with mortgages or lost their jobs. And so thousands of Americans packed up their pickup trucks and their fifth-wheelers and went out to the Bakken oil field to work on the rigs, to work in the field. This is the western part of the state, so it's, you know, North Dakota is largely flat, wide-open prairie land, but in the western half, you start to hit the badlands a little bit. And I went to a place called McKenzie County, which is traditionally agricultural ranching land, and I got, you know, I moved within the system right at the beginning. I took a jet through Minneapolis, as you have to do if you want to get to North Dakota, and I rented a car, and I drove to a little campground on the banks of the Missouri River called Lake Sakakawea. And the idea was I had my backpack that I bought 20 years earlier, and I was just going to kind of walk into the thick of it and see what was going on. And a kind woman there named Peg Helen Sass, who owned the campground, said, "Hey, you can leave your car here for a week. You just got to find your way back." And so I did. After a good night's sleep, I set off into the prairie.
Now, why was it so important for you to walk and camp through these energy landscapes?
Two reasons. The first reason, I think, on a personal level, was this is a book about, to me, about nature in the end and how we use nature on a big level. I know I'm writing about energy. We're talking about fuel and climate change and all these things. But in the end, I mean, we're animals, right? I'm an animal. You know, we're a species of animals, and we kind of forget that as human beings. And for me, I think I wanted to feel these places. And so when I was going into North Dakota, I wanted to be out there when it was hot. I wanted to be, lying on the ground in the dark of night, this kind of thing, to kind of feel the place as...
It's like that connection that you talked about earlier when people had to chop their own wood or... I don't know, build their own hydroelectric dams or whatever.
For sure. And the second piece of it was, as a journalist, I kind of wanted to slow the scale of time for myself. I didn't want to be rushing around inside a car with air conditioning, pulling up to a place, asking if I could interview somebody. I sort of wanted to almost like mentally break myself out of it. And so I would see things a little differently. And, you know, I would cover 10 or 12 miles a day. And 10 or 12 miles a day in North Dakota, you're going 70 miles an hour. You can do that in 9 minutes in a car. and this would be my whole day's work. And then the second piece is, as a journalist, I knew that it would put me in positions to meet people, to see things. People thought at first that I was an oil worker who had lost my pickup truck. I was down on my luck.
Yeah, your truck broken down?
Yeah, they
let
would
me
pull
help
up,
you out.
"Hey, friend, do you need a ride?"
Yeah, because nobody's walking along those highways in North Dakota. My goodness.
Nobody is walking. And, you know, pickup trucks would pull over and the window would come down from the air conditioning and someone would say, "Do you need a ride?" And I'd say, "No, I want to be out here." and they would think, "Okay." But what it really did was people sort of saw me as part of the place. And they were as curious about me as I was about them. And so it ended up, it's a longer story, but, I ended up on an oil rig for an afternoon. Journalists do not typically get on oil rigs. I mean, I met a fella and I told him what I'm doing and, "Hey, can I come on your oil rig? I'm writing a book." Absolutely. I'm sure if I had been driving down the road in a rented Impala with my notebook, they would, the guy would have said, "You got to call corporate."
Yeah.
And so the idea was really a friend of mine sent a note saying, "Hey, you've arrived in a place no one gets to by accident. And so you're part of the team there. You're part of the place." And I really felt that, people saw me as they're like, "Hey, if this guy's willing to stroll across the prairie for day after day, I'll take some time and talk to him."
Well, how did people there in North Dakota feel about their relatively new status as an oil-producing community? I mean, North Dakota, there's not a lot of people there, or there at least there used to not be a lot of people, a lot of ranchers. Mm-hmm. So how do they feel about that new status?
So it's a very mixed thing. And first of all, in North Dakota, there had been a little bit of history of oil development back in the 50s and 60s and even in the 80s, but it was more traditional. It never redefined the place. Maybe a family would have a well and it would make a little difference. But I can tell you more about it, but there were winners and losers, depending on mineral rights. If you own the rights to the oil underneath your grant land, you would profit handsomely from it. Some farmers don't. And so they've got wells on their land and they see relatively little money. But there is also, so on the one hand, changes, they saw the economic vitality and kids could stay in town. On the other hand, it was changing the way of life, and I can tell you more about that.
Okay, too. Yeah, we'll talk about that after a short break. And a similar story in Pennsylvania, again, where natural gas has been found in large measure. There's some similar changes there in societies in terms of wealth and how people feel about it. We'll talk about that after a short break, and we'll start taking your calls at 1-800-892-6477.
Does your mystery machine leave you stranded at the worst possible times?
I think we're in trouble. trouble already. Look!
Haunted mansion?
If you're terrified by the thought of putting more money into your unreliable vehicle, why not donate it to NHPR and transform it into the programs you love, like All Things Considered in the Exchange, and podcasts like Bear Brook. We'll take care of the paperwork and we'll even tow it away for free. Donate your vehicle today at nhpr.org/cardonation.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today, Walking to the Sun, a new book by a UNH author on his pilgrimage through America's energy consumption landscapes, both traditional fossil fuels and renewables. It was a journey, he says, aimed at closing the gap between the ease of energy consumption and the difficulty of energy production. Let's hear from you. Send email to exchange@nhpr.org. Again, exchange@nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange, or give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. And Tom, just before the break, we were talking about your trip, your first landscape that you walked through, the oil fields of North Dakota. And I was asking you about how the people there felt about the changes in their lives from this, you know, sudden rush of oil production. And you said there were, you know, definitely negatives, but also a lot of positives.
Yeah, I mean, first I'll just kind of set the scene. So this area of North Dakota is wide open, right? Rugged land, sort of the classic windswept prairie, right? And over the last century, there had been sort of a boom of family farming from the early 1900s, and there were communities sprung up. I walked through a place called Charleston, North Dakota, in McKenzie County, that had been home to more than 300 people in the 1940s and 50s. But since then, as has happened in much of America, particularly in the big sort of western reaches, it was hard to keep the family farm. Farming got more industrialized. And so in Charleston now, there are four families effectively farming the same amount of land. So, you know, a lot of my point is that these are communities out of which a lot of people have moved. A lot of young people have gone off to the city.
We've seen a rural depopulation in a lot of areas.
And if you've ever seen one of those National Geographic issues of North Dakota, you know, the sort of the sideways leaning barn with the roof starting to cave in, you know, a lot of that, right? At the same time, a lot of big industrial scale farming going on, soybeans or spring wheat or whatever, but it was into that sort of terrain that the oil boom came, right? And so you had basically then, I just depended on who you talked to, but there were some ranchers who, it's a place that has a tradition of kind of the land is a resource, right? So oil's a resource. So yes, if someone came in and drilled on their land, there was a psychology of like, that's what we're supposed to be doing. It gives us, you know, money, my kids can stay around. But again, as I was explaining too, without getting too far into North Dakota law, there's mineral rights, and some farmers didn't even own the mineral rights to their land. So these are not sort of subtle things. You know, we're talking 250-foot high drilling rig coming in, drilling 2 miles down, 2 miles over, and leaving an operating well. Sometimes within, if I'm remembering correctly, I think they can drill within 250 feet or 500 feet of a farmhouse. So there are, you know, some people who were used to the high lonely plains and their way of life who all of a sudden had an industrial zone right around their house.
You talked about that disconnect between energy consumption and energy production, and how most of us, especially here in New England, don't really see that. But if you're a North Dakota farmer and all of a sudden there's an oil rig, you know, in your visual backyard, you're not disconnected anymore. It's right there.
You're not disconnected, even though that oil might be going off, you know, to a processing plant in Texas, right? But you were basically all of a sudden in the backyard of America's energy industry, right? And so the other interesting thing about North Dakota is North Dakota farmers need water, and they have a great appreciation for the table water and the water as a resource, and clean water specifically. So there was a lot more awareness and uncertainty of people I talked to of, wow, this is great, but boy, we're pumping millions of gallons of water into these wells to frack them with chemicals, and we're not sure what's going on there. I talked to one rancher, Donnie Nelson, who's, you know, third generation, both grandparents kind of homesteaded, et cetera, who just said, look, you're talking about human beings and machines and things will go wrong, you know? And so there was a kind of, you know, organic level of nervousness there among some people that, you know, this land is all we got, right? And if we're ripping it up, literally to get the oil out, you know, they will be the ones who pay for that.
Let's go to our listeners, sure. And then I want to talk about some of these other landscapes that you walked through, although I'm really intrigued by some of these stories about North Dakota. We could
absolutely
probably talk a lot
we
more
could
about
talk, yeah.
that. But other landscapes that Tom Haines walked through include natural gas in Pennsylvania and New York, where mm-hmm. the sensibility about natural gas is different. Also coal in Wyoming, solar in California. So we'll talk about all that. And you can join us to 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Tom, Linda's on the line from Durham, your hometown. Hi, Linda. Go ahead. You're on the air. Welcome.
Hi. Good morning. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I just wanted to point out one thing that you haven't been talking about as a local source of energy, which is geothermal. I think most people don't realize that at just 5 feet down into the earth is 55 degrees. And geothermal heating systems are able to capture that heat. So it's a local source of energy. It works terrific in the Northeast. And I had a geothermal system put in when I bought my house about 4 years ago. And it's been keeping me toasty ever since.
Wow.
I think it replaced a propane furnace. And it harvests the heat. And it can either be, if you have some open land, you can just dig a 5 foot deep trench, or if you just have a small lot, you can have a well driller drill the hole to put the piping down into the ground to harvest that heat. You do have to use a little more electricity to run the heat pumps that concentrate the heat and bring it up above 55 to warm your house. But I put in solar panels to harvest the sun to do that, and now I'm basically not burning fossil fuels to heat my home in this very cold New England winter.
And you are definitely not disconnected from your energy sources there, Linda. It's all right there in her home. Did you look into geothermal? There isn't really a geothermal landscape that you can walk through, right?
I didn't look into geothermal, but first of all, I think, you know, Linda's absolutely right, and I think you know, that's awesome to be using that resource. And I think that's the kind of thing we need to be doing is sort of exploring both local and industrial scale stuff, whether it's backyard energy out of something like geothermal. And the reason why I didn't was I was primarily concerned sort of just as sort of the yang to the yin of fossil fuels to going to these looking at sources that could kind of on an industrial level feed the grid. And geothermal absolutely can, too. It was just I had to stop somewhere. But I do think to Linda's point, it's important that places where we can be pushing the boundaries of both the technology that's being used, but also kind of the affordability of it, the more people who are using geothermal in their homes, that creates a market for it. These companies will go after it. Anyway, that's a whole other question of what we need to be doing. But I think,
when we talk about the disconnect, again, Linda is an example of someone who is not disconnected because it's right there.
Right, absolutely.
At her home level. I want to ask you about natural gas, Tom, because that's really important. Here in New England, as you know, we rely heavily, many people say too heavily, on natural gas. Now, you went to New York and Pennsylvania.
Mm-hmm.
When did this region develop as a natural gas source? Just refresh our
memories.
Similarly, there.
Yeah. I mean, the Pennsylvania, if I'm remembering correctly, so quick dynamic. In New York, they had a moratorium and now an essential ban on natural gas fracking. And in Pennsylvania, they embraced it, essentially, sort of at the political level. And so in Pennsylvania, about 14, 15 years ago, 2005, 2006, there was some sort of exploratory well drilling, and particularly up in the northeast part of the state. I walked from sort of near the town of Ithaca in New York, south across the border into Susquehanna County, which was one of the most heavily drilled counties.
That's a long walk.
It's a long walk. It was 70 miles.
Wow.
Yeah. So
camping
again,
with your backpack.
With my backpack, sleeping in a state forest. I'm from Pittsburgh and I needed a place to stay one night, and I passed a guy's house and he was wearing a Steelers hat, and so I said, "Hey, Steelers," you know. And the next thing you know, he said,
"Can
yeah,
I sleep
you
in your yard?"
He said, "Yeah, you can sleep in my yard." He even invited his grown kids over for a barbecue that night. So it was it was a long walk, but in Susquehanna County, you know, really over the last decade in Pennsylvania.
So pretty recent, really.
Pretty recently, and certainly in the big sweep of time, very recently. But that gas field went from an exploratory well a little bit more than a decade ago to, I believe, at present, more than 5,000, if not 8,000 wells statewide.
So what did the places in Pennsylvania that host fracking look like? I'm wondering about the actual facility, Tom, but also the towns nearby.
So totally different. different landscape than North Dakota. If North Dakota was the big wide open prairie, Pennsylvania, if you've driven through it, it's not dissimilar from New Hampshire.
It's very forested.
It's heavily wooded, lots of ups and downs and hills. I never knew how many, even though I'm from there, until I walked them. But as one, I actually had talked to a lawyer before I went down who was involved in sort of representing people who didn't want fracking, and he said it's very two-dimensional. You only see what isn't blocked. And he was right. You know, I was walking down these roads cloaked in forest, and so you didn't have, whereas in North Dakota, you could look out for miles and see the flares at night at these oil drilling rigs. Pennsylvania was almost, you knew it was very close. There were times I was walking within a quarter mile of a fracking site, and you didn't even know it because it was behind trees, over a hill, down a hill. And so it just depended. In certain towns I had arrived, the wells had been drilled, the fracking was done, and so they were just little capped natural gas wells, you know, maybe 5 feet off the ground, the pipes. But I ended up in the town of Dimmock, which is famous from a film called Gasland, where people may have seen footage of people lighting their tap water on fire.
Oh, yes, I did hear about that.
Methane into the wells. And at first the company said, no, it never happened. It wasn't us. Eventually, the state environmental agency determined that, yes, you know, this was caused by the drilling. And I ended up on the farm of Ron and Ann Teal, who had had the first exploratory well drilled for fracking on their land. And they had been big.
The first ever in
Pennsylvania. Well, in this kind of round from a company called Cabot Oil and Gas. And they had been big proponents for years, even during the time when people said that their neighbors, their tanks, their water wells were being contaminated. They had said, this is great. This is energy for America. You know, why not? We're using this resource. And by the time I arrived, this one-page contract they had signed with the gas company had turned into 8 wells on their land, 22,000 feet of pipeline underground on their 300-acre farm, and a compressor station for natural gas that is about the size of a football field. So, again, a factory, essentially, for basically capturing the gas from nearby wells in the valley and sending it into the Tennessee pipeline toward New York and New Hampshire. So, you know, it had their field, their farm had essentially become a factory.
And were they okay with that? I mean,
no,
they did sign a contract.
They're very straightforward people, and they understand that they were responsible for what had happened. Like they took accountability for their actions. But by the time I arrived, they had just as Ann Teal said, we were the guinea pigs. We didn't know what this was going to bring. You know, we thought, okay, this will be a little bit of development. We'll have a well on our land. They didn't realize that what they were welcoming in essentially was the full weight of the industry, which is, you know, essentially what we all demand. You know,
so
what we all
contrast for us, Tom, Pennsylvania and New York, because as you said, Pennsylvania has embraced this. New York has said, you know, and yet New York is sitting on a fair bit of this natural gas too, right?
Yeah, and they do what's, you know, conventional natural gas drilling.
So they are extracting it.
Yeah, particularly in the western part of the state. But what they have banned is hydraulic fracking, hydraulic fracturing. So fracking, this use of chemicals that splinters the rock and that, you know, can damage the water table and all this kind of stuff. And so New York is a very different political world, there too it was very much a grassroots thing. I started in a town called Dryden, visiting a woman named Marie McRae, who was a farmer, and she had actually signed a lease with there was some speculative lease signing going on because the industry thought we'll be able to frack in New York, and she had signed a lease because her neighbors all had, and she was sort of overwhelmed by the situation, as in her description, and then she realized this isn't right, and so she and others led a drive in their town of Dryden, which became a state Supreme Court case for the town to ban fracking before the state did. And so it's been something that on the one hand has come top down from Albany and New York, but also from the grassroots level, I think there was just really an effort there to say, we're moving too fast.
Although we talked earlier, Tom, about the struggles of rural America, and a lot of people you talk to in these energy landscapes, we're happy to see the energy companies
Absolutely.
Come because there has been this depopulation in many rural areas, especially young people, you know, don't seem to want to live in rural areas anymore. So a lot of parents you talk to, you know, middle-aged people said, this is fantastic. Now my son or daughter will have some viable employment and they can stay.
Yeah, and absolutely. And more than that, I mean, North Dakota, I met people from 31 states who are working in North Dakota.
Oh,
right?
Wow.
So New Hampshire, Maine, Vermont, but up and down the Rockies, through the American Southeast, through the West Coast.
Drawn to North Dakota, which has not been a big draw.
No, but they were there for effectively the gold rush, right? I mean, it was the oil rush. And I met a record producer from Nashville who had lost his job and like went out to North Dakota, and he was working for $50 an hour siting pipeline. I got offered jobs to site pipeline. People would say, hey, you're already walking. Why don't you make some money? but no, you know, it was really, I mean, this is our economy, right? Our economy, our jobs, we live in a world that still is a fossil fuel based economy. And that's one of the challenges right now, right? That's where we, you know, I mean, if you're obviously, if we want people to be able to earn money for their families, that's where they are. And one of the big pushes, obviously, is now in renewables. There are those fields are developing enough that there are great jobs there, too. And I can talk about that in Texas, in the wind country. And that's, you know, as a society, that's one of our challenges.
Well, and I do want to turn to that, to the fields, the wind fields, the solar fields that you encountered. A less than successful but still interesting experiment in tidal power in Maine. I also want to remind our listeners that you can join us at 1-800-892-6477. We're talking about a new book that explores the disconnect that many of us have between our own pretty easy energy consumption and the real harsh realities of energy production. Join us, 1-800-892-6477. The author is Tom Haynes. The book is called Walking to the Sun. You know, after you talk to people in Pennsylvania and New York, but more Pennsylvania, because that's where a lot of natural gas comes from now. Did you chuck your natural gas water heater when you got home?
It's not that easy. That's the problem we all live in. I am happy to report I have solar panels on my roof, so that helps. But I will tell you what it's done for me personally is I am just more aware, right? So I'll tell you, I turn off the lights a lot more. I take shorter showers. I harangue my kids to turn off the lights a lot more.
Ever since Dad wrote that book, he's been really irritating.
It's just nothing's any fun anymore. I am fortunate enough to be able to walk or ride my bike to work. You know, I try to, if I have to run errands, I try to kind of group them together so that I'm taking fewer trips in my vehicle. So, you know, there are things that I am doing, but I think the point of the book is that we've reached a point as a society where we need to solve the problem. We absolutely have to be doing things like, if I'm remembering the caller's name, Linda, at the home level, absolutely, you know, solar panels,
geothermal,
everything helps, and a lot of that solution can come, depending on where you are and what your resource is, at a kind of local micro level. But we need to change the system of our energy, right? We need to change like the industrial scale that is feeding the grid, that is feeding, you know, the light switches we turn on, the, you know, everything. And so that's what the book is about, is sort of a reckoning of the fossil fuels and then kind of an exploration of industrial scale. In this case, tidal as an example of one thing that may become something. Wind, which is something that's become an industrial scale energy source, and I can talk more about that. And solar, which certainly has also become an industrial scale energy source. So, you know, I think that's my point is like, yes, it's changed how I live in my home to some degree, but it's also really deepened my understanding that it's not something, I mean, everybody needs to kind of take steps to consume less and be more efficient, but we as a society need to change our overall grid and system in which we live. And that starts with this industrial scale stuff.
Well, and I wonder what your thoughts are, Tom, on sort of industrial or macro versus micro, mm-hmm. because a lot of the fights come because of these large scale solar projects, you know, wind projects and so forth. People don't like seeing these big mm-hmm. things on their local landscapes, in their backyards, even if it is a solar panel or a wind turbine or whatever. So we'll talk about that disconnect in just a moment. And we'll keep taking your calls. Linda, thank you for that one. Our number here in the exchange is 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email if you'd like, exchange@nhpr.org. Now, coming up, we will switch gears with author Tom Haynes about his walk through the landscapes of energy production here in the country. We will hear about some of those renewable walks, and there are still trade-offs, as he's going to tell us. Nothing's perfect. We'll find out a lot more after a short break, so keep it right here. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Tomorrow on our show, our Civics 101 team explains how midterms work and why they're so important. That's tomorrow on The Exchange. This hour, a pilgrimage across America's energy production landscapes with UNH Associate Professor and author Tom Haynes. His new book is called Walking to the Sun. Join us, 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. And Tom, right back to our listeners. Bill's calling from Stratum. Hi, Bill. You're on the air. Thanks for being with us.
Yeah, thanks for taking my call. Hi, Tom. This is Bill, who used to live in the house you used.
Hello, Bill. It's good to hear your voice. The house with the wonderful wood stove.
And the natural gas water heater.
Right. Above ground carbon. So wonderful to hear your voice and recognize what a great idea for a book. So I'm just curious to know your thoughts about, in addition to the little things we can do, what are some of the policy approaches that we can take as a country? And in your walks, did you find that there were people who were more or less willing to take some of that on? And I'll take my answer off the air. Thanks, Tom.
Bill, great to hear from you.
Absolutely. I mean, that is sort of the big takeaway for me is that we need to be, and I'm not a policy analyst, so I'm not going to say, okay, we need to be doing X, Y, or Z, but we need to be doing everything we can to transition from fossil fuels to renewables. And for example, I'll just point to one that smarter people than me have come up with. The IPCC report 2 weeks ago pointed to the idea of what, for lack of a better term, is sort of a carbon tax, right? Putting a cost on the use of carbon, forwarded by William Nordhaus and others, who's a Nobel Prize winning economist. And the idea is that And this is being adopted at different levels around the world by countries in the EU, by British Columbia, different places, and to some extent here in California. But there's a ballot initiative in Washington State next week that Washington Staters will vote on to sort of essentially charge producers of carbon-based fuels, right? A price to sell that, because this
and
is what's
us in the end.
And
they
us in the end
they
is
won't eat
right
because
that'll
costs.
Get right. That'll get passed to us, right? But the point being that if we are ever going to kind of really invest in this transition, we need to break the inertia of the financial grip of the fossil fuel system. And I don't mean that as any kind of radical overthrow thing. I mean that as a sort of, that's the world in which we live in. It is so powerful and it is such the status quo that unless we are willing to sort of de-incentivize the use of that or incentivize the non-use of it, and then take some of that money and invest in whether it's wind or solar or geothermal or tidal or wherever, you know, the applications depending on where you are and what's going on, it's not going to happen. There have been some efforts, and Texas is a place I went where there was some legislation and incentivization and investment in wind. And the wind, it has the most industrial scale wind energy production in the nation. And it's a really happy story.
Well, I really want to ask you about Texas because it's fascinating. Because when people think Texas, they think oil, but you say no, wind. But got another email here that kind of relates to what Bill is saying. John sent us an email. He says, just finished reading the book. Well written, unique approach. Enjoyed it very much. John says, in the world of energy followers, we are divided into one of two camps, doomers or cornucopians. Doomers look at our energy predicament and conclude there is no way out and we are doomed. Cornucopians see a vast array of energy alternatives we can turn to and carry on with little sacrifice or change. Can't quite figure out where the author lands, John says. His book tries to leave us hopeful, yet there are definite undercurrents of hopelessness. And John says, would like to hear his comments on this. John, well put. Doomers or cornucopians? Which one are you after writing this book?
Yeah, thanks, John. And first of all, thanks for reading the book. I appreciate it. I think I'm sort of in the middle looking at both sides as he describes it, right? I think the realist in me, having done this kind of reckoning of fossil fuels, sees the sort of the scale of our dilemma, right? We consume so much energy as a nation, still 80% of which is coming from fossil fuels. The International Energy Agency has done did a forecast looking that by 2050, global energy production or energy consumption will increase, and the portion, and we will be using to fuel that, even though it may be a smaller percentage, on a raw level, more oil, gas, and coal than we are today, right? So unless, you know, if we just keep going.
Which seems amazing because we use so much already.
Right. That's what, so that part of me is I wouldn't say that doesn't make me feel doomed, but I think it's important that we realize that we as a society just sort of face the scale of what we consume as a way of, this is the information is power thing, as a way of knowing the size of the problem. Because if we don't face it, then we just think, nothing can be done or it'll be okay. But the optimist in me.
The cornucopian.
Is going to these places, and specifically we were talking about Texas. Texas has the most industrial scale wind energy development, right, in the state or in the United States. And there was a night when I was there in March of 2017. I was walking through Carson County in the Panhandle, which is one has had, you know, hundreds and hundreds of wind towers built on these industrial scale wind farms. This is big business, by the way, $400 million to build a wind farm with 202-megawatt turbines.
Oh, that's a lot of turbines. Built
by companies like General Electric and Siemens, financed by companies like Citibank and Morgan Stanley. So you're starting to see some of this economy shift, right? Employing hundreds of people to build these things at really good rates. So my point is, like, that's hopeful, right? Maybe we can build an economy around this renewable energy. But more to the point, there was an evening where total energy consumption on the grid in Texas, which is called ERCOT, was nearly 50% produced by wind. So think about that. Houston, Dallas, San Antonio, Austin, every little town in between, every hospital, every convenience store, every home, every air conditioning running, nearly half of the energy that was powering all of that was coming from wind power. That's not theoretical. That's not cornucopian or the unicorn or whatever. That is a real applied example. And it's not perfect. And people will say, oh, well, you couldn't do that everywhere. And they're right. You know, there are reasons where you can't do it everywhere, but you can do it a lot of places.
So could those Texans, harness all that wind power and put it on the grid for us here in New England?
Or are we stuck with natural gas pipelines? So yes and no. I mean, there can certainly be more wind in other parts of the country. There's a lot of wind in the Appalachians, and offshore wind is booming. I was just talking to a fellow who's involved in huge offshore wind projects off in New Jersey and New England. And but the other thing is that. Transmission and storage are the two big kind of technical hurdles. And again, I'm not an engineer, but I've talked to a bunch. We need better battery storage. That's one of the big questions that, like, great minds and are sort of racing toward. How can we store, so when it's really windy, how can we store that so that 3 in the morning when it's not, well, actually it is windy at 3 in the morning, but, 6 in the morning when it's not, that we can feed the grid, and similar with solar. How can we basically store these renewable energies so that we can feed the grid at peak demand time? And how can we also transfer it? And so, you know, that does mean more power lines. That means, you know, and we were talking about this, Laura, you and I, that I feel like, you know, we're beyond the time of perfect solutions, right?
Well, and let me
everything
ask you
is
going to
be
that.
A compromise. Yeah. Everything's going to be a compromise.
Because with wind here in New Hampshire anyway, there are a lot of complaints. The turbines are big, they're ugly, they make noise. This is just the complaints. I'm not saying this is me talking. They hurt birds, they hurt bats. We care a lot about bird migration in mm-hmm. this state. So you've had a lot of pushback against mm-hmm. wind here in New Hampshire. I wonder how people in Texas that you talk to, I mean, you walk through their backyards and their neighborhoods, how did they feel about living side by side in this giant, it sounds giant, I can't even imagine how big it is.
Yeah, again, this is wide open prairie, and picture sitting, many people in New Hampshire have probably looked out at off the coast at the ocean at night, and you've seen a boat bobbing at its buoy with a light on or something, and picture thousands of those out on the prairie. Or the night when I was camped, you would look and you would see thousands of these blinking red lights. It looked like a sea, and those were wind towers. And again, they're mixed. There are some people, I talked to a farmer who stopped, they pulled up in his truck as I was walking, and he said, what are you doing? I said, I'm writing about wind energy. Oh, these damn towers, it's ruined the place, right? He remembers being a kid running around, and he said, the highest thing anywhere was a fence post. That being said, we need to we need to figure out what choices are we going to make. And so that what in his case was an unseen fuel powering his life, coal, oil, and gas, allowed him to have this beautiful prairie, was essentially, we've known for decades now, emitting carbon dioxide into the atmosphere, the leading cause of global warming. And now we're learning all these different, we know about increased intensity of storms, sea level level rise, rising temperatures of air and ocean, ice melt, sea level rise, intense drought, intense fire. You know, watch the hurricane season. These are harbingers of what we're facing. And we're into we don't know what we're doing anymore in terms of, you know, this impacts where they go. And scientists know, but I'm saying as a society. And so we need to be more open to, I think, as much as I hate to see any place industrialized, I love walking through beautiful forest, beautiful wilderness. And but we're in an area now where we need to make hard decisions.
So we just have to get used to ugliness? Is that what you're saying?
Yeah. And I think we also have to acknowledge that we've always had ugliness, that we just haven't seen it. And it's often in places that are either out of the way or, you know, oftentimes, you know, if you've ever driven through Houston and the oil refineries and, you know, put right next to communities that don't have a lot of economic resources, you know, and so we sort of oftentimes, and certainly in New England, it's a different deal because we get our energy from often far away. We just don't see it. But yeah, I think we need to sort of look more closely at what we've done and what we need to do.
So in terms of this macro versus micro, again, a lot of people here in New Hampshire had and have problems with industrial-sized wind. Of course, there was an industrial-sized hydropower project called Northern Pass. A lot of people had problems with that because it was just big, big, big. Mm-hmm. There have even been local debates about large-scale solar farms and so forth. So, you know, my question sometimes is, Tom, if everybody is so upset about these large-scale projects, can't we just micro it?
Again, yeah. I mean, I think if you look at the total need, the one answer should be we absolutely should be microing it wherever we can.
Instead of getting used to living next to, you know, again, what a lot of people would say is ugly.
Right, absolutely. But the other flip side of that, though, is we're $7 billion and growing, and we fuel a system that is, you know, I can travel from here to Carson County, Texas, without ever really going outdoors. Once I walk in the doors of Manchester Airport, you know, I get on a plane, I sit in a tube, I fly through the sky, I land in Dallas. We've built this kind of industrial infrastructure that we support. And so that's why, you know, we do need industrial scale renewable energy if we're going to feed the demands of ourselves as a society. In addition to, and absolutely, I mean, my message, my takeaway from this on a personal level is we should be exploring and as fast as we possibly can development of all renewable technologies, whether it's micro in the backyard or on your rooftop or macro. And we have hard decisions to make, but I think it's up to our political leaders and our corporate leaders to be leading that conversation and to be representing those realities.
Well, let's talk a little bit about solar, Tom. And you walked through the Mojave Desert, exploring the solar field there. We've been talking about the environmental costs, the human health costs of energy production. You've been talking a lot about the, you know, more disastrous predictions around climate change. But you also say no form of energy is free. These huge solar farms that you walked through in California also had costs associated with them. What are those, Tom?
Different. I mean, on an environmental, just on a really talk about micro-environmental. So these solar farms are something that you maybe are not, that people maybe think here photovoltaic, which are these kind of banks of flat panels that absorb the sun's energy. The place where I walked was what's called a concentrated solar array. So it's hundreds of thousands of mirrors in the desert the size of ping pong tables.
Wow, that's hard for me to imagine.
Yeah, it's very space age, right, in terms of its look.
There's a lot of solar in Vermont that I've seen, but nothing on that scale.
So what it is, it's literally very elemental. The sun shines down on these mirrors. These mirrors are controlled by computers to point at a tower that has a heating unit at the top of it that literally gets, you know, that takes all this concentrated energy of the sun. Now, one of the problems is little birds flying by this tower literally explode, right?
Wow.
They explode. They fly into
so hot
the field of the
so
concentrated
close.
Solar energy and they explode. And absolutely, is that nice? Is that good? I don't know what to do with that. I don't think that's great. But at the same time, you can read stories about salt marsh sparrows living in the salt marshes of New Hampshire, the salt marshes of Connecticut, that are their populations are dwindling because of sea level rise, right? So this is my point. We have to decide what we're going to do. We have to be smart about it. We can't be naive and to think that that, you know, we can't develop a new technology because it damages something, because we already are damaging something.
So to be really kind of harsh and specific, you would say to people who say, I don't like solar because there's these exploding birds, which is pretty horrible to think about. I don't like wind because the birds get, you know, caught up in the turbines or their patterns are disturbed. You would say, fine, understand, but birds are also suffering because of climate change based on fossil fuels. We just don't see it. It's not as obvious.
Birds in the entire ecosystem is suffering because of climate change. And so I think that or will be suffering more. And I think are the ways that we can manage individual projects to minimize, you know, that fewer birds die or wind farms are done in a way. And they do that. And in Texas, they take they go to great effort to kind of do it in a way that has the least amount of impact. And so I certainly want to be smart about that. But at the same time, we have tough choices to make, and we have to acknowledge those compromises.
Well, Marjorie emails to say the current state legislation is not very encouraging for community solar. The price paid per kilowatt for group net metering is basically cut in half to about 7 cents versus 12 to 13 cents, Marjorie says, for larger solar arrays. Theoretically, she says, people could be taxed on the money paid to them. If we truly want to fuel our electrical needs from local and regional distributed energy, we need to change the rules around net metering to encourage it. Marjorie, thank you so much for the email. We've done a lot of shows on this and will in the future. But for now, we appreciate your comments. Another comment from our listeners, Bill emails. He says, I have spent quite a bit of time in the Texas Panhandle and have seen the wind farms. Bill says, maybe I'm crazy, but I find the site beautiful. Give me the, quote, blight of a wind farm any day over an oil slick, smoggy air, or the billowing steam from a power plant. So there's Bill and Marjorie. Thank you both. Go ahead, Tom.
And I mean, as a way to kind of bring it home from my walks, I feel like that too. So I slept, you know, literally beneath oil rigs and next to coal tracks and above the compressor station of the natural gas and felt sort of the pressure and heard the squeals and the grinds of that process. And I slept beneath a wind turbine, as I think it was Bill who just said, out in West Texas, literally beneath one of these womp, womp, womp kind of. And on an elemental level, that felt right. It felt like the way that we as human beings should be energizing ourselves. And that may sound kind of out there, but, well, I was out there.
So did working on this book make you feel more positive?
If we
more cornucopia-ish, to quote our earlier
email, John.
It made
me optimistic that we can solve this problem and make great strides if we get to work fast.
How convinced are you that we collectively will get to work?
On the fence. I mean, who knows? I hope that our political leaders and our corporate leaders and everyone and us as voters, because this is us, we're the consumers, we're the ones causing it, we're the ones living it, prioritize this to do what we can to get moving to solve this problem.
All right. Tom Haines, it's been really nice to talk to you. Thank you very much.
Thanks very much for having me, Laura. It's been great to talk to you.
That's UNH Associate Professor Tom Haines. His new book is called Walking to the Sun, A Journey Through America's Energy Landscapes. The Exchange is a production of NHPR. The engineer is Dan Colgan. Our senior producer is Ellen Grimm. Our producers are Jessica Hunt and Christina Phillips. Our theme music was composed by Bob Lord, and I'm Laura Kanoi.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you liked what you heard, spread the word. Give us a review on Apple Podcasts to help other listeners find us. And thanks.